From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a shot in Kirsten Johnson's documentary. It's a long country road in rural Missouri. It's green, dark clouds in the background. And the shot is in the frame for a long time. And then we see lightning. And in most films, you'd probably use that shot, but not the audio of the camera person, in this case Kirsten herself, gasping in surprise. But throughout this remarkably personal film, she breaks down that barrier. We see Kirsten setting up her shots, working them out in footage from her 25 years as a documentary cinematographer. Today in the program, Kirsten Johnson is joining us to talk about this fragmentary portrait she's created, a memoir about the impact of being filmed on the subject and on the filmmaker. It's called Camera Person. We're screening it next week, talking about it after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're watching a documentary, it's easy to forget that someone is shooting that scene playing out in front of you. And in most cases, that's the idea. For 25 years as a documentary cinematographer, Kirsten Johnson stayed behind her camera, shooting images for films like Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 or Laura Poitras's Citizen 4. And Johnson says she's always been aware of the dilemmas she faced as a camera person, shooting in places where there's desperate poverty or terrible violence. One of the dilemmas is knowing that you don't really have anything to offer these people, and you know you can leave that place. Usually the people can't. What she says she didn't expect was how these kinds of dilemmas would impact her. Johnson has taken the footage, fragments of 24 documentaries she's worked on, and she's made a kind of memoir that she says conveys just how complex it is to film and be filmed. The documentary is called Camera Person. We're going to be screening it next week. Today in the program, we're talking to Kirsten Johnson about the film. When she joined us last week, she had been listening to the news, and she heard stories from Nigeria, from Yemen, from Sudan, all places she's been. She said hearing the news transported her back, and I asked her if that happens to her a lot.
I mean, it literally just happened to me right now. Because, you know, they said there are three countries where people are facing severe malnutrition, and then they named the places, and I saw people's faces in my mind as they listed the countries.
It seems like that's one of the things that you wanted to get at in the film, that idea of reliving those things when an image when you see an image again or it comes back to you?
Yeah. I mean, what's so interesting to me, I am someone who loves photography, loves movies, loves documentaries, which I consider movies. and I love striking images, and I search to create striking images. And, you know, I don't think we can say about our own images that they're indelible, but you're hoping to create an indelible image. That's what we're really, those of us who love creating visual work, and I think sound people are the same. You know, people want to record a moment that no one can forget. But then it turns out that you can't forget it, you who have done the recording. And yet you can forget it because there's so much, you've taken in so much, and so much of it is so emotionally strong that you can't hold on to it all simultaneously.
Yeah. So what got you started thinking about this? I know there was a big influence on your thinking when you were starting to want to make a documentary in 2009 in Afghanistan. It seemed like that really generated a lot of thinking on this.
Absolutely, yes. Well, you know, this backstory is that in 2009, I went to Afghanistan with the chance to film young women who are receiving education there and in a fairly hostile climate. And we thought while we were making it that, you know, there was this sort of sudden realization that I was probably putting people in more danger by filming them than what any film could ever do for that specific set of people. So I sort of pulled out of that and then focused my attention on a couple of teenagers who we felt were really in a position to own the fact of being filmed. They were sort of out in the world in a way where it seemed like they could be safe if their images were filmed. And yet, by the end of the project in 2012, when I showed the basically finished film to one of the young women, she said, "No, now I'm too afraid. I know I said I could be in a movie, but I can't anymore." And that was, you know, it was just one of those things where you think you understand what's going on. You think you understand the political context and the people that you're filming with. You know you're naive. You know there are things you're missing. But I think one of the primary things that I had missed, in a way, is this sort of line that changed history, which was the moment in which the internet became so prevalent around the world that the distribution of images could go anywhere. And then when that, you know, sort of spread out into the smartphones everywhere around the world, suddenly any place that you thought you could say, you know, "Don't worry, we'll film this image of you, but no one will ever see it."
Yeah.
That turned out to be wrong.
Right.
And so I was right in that cusp of that moment in Afghanistan where, when I started, there was no way her neighbors were going to see the film. And when we ended the film, for sure, her neighbors could pull it up on YouTube, no problem.
Yeah. You've talked about this. You've acknowledged that it's the film itself that you've created now is a kind of a fragmentary portrait. And I wondered, how do you describe what it is to people? It's so interesting because I'm like, I was thinking, all right, is it even okay for me, which I kind of want to do through the hour, it's okay if you don't, like, is it okay for us to even tease out moments from this thing, or is it better to think of it as a whole, as this integrated whole? You know what I mean?
Well, I do know what you mean. I'll tell you for sure, when we were trying to get it made, it was really difficult to describe, and everyone would say, "Oh, I can't imagine it."
Yeah.
And I have to say, now I experience the great pleasure of everyone telling me, "I've never seen anything like it."
Exactly.
And, you know, so that is great to be on this side of it. But I'm really interested in how people respond to the film, and I feel that that's how the film continues to be made. It is being made as it's being watched.
Yeah.
So literally every screening I do, someone describes the film to me in a new way. Someone the other day told me it was an exorcism. And
wow.
I was like, wow, haven't heard that one before. Another person told me the film is structured like the way Alzheimer's functions. You know, it just goes on and on where someone understands the world differently than you do. A Korean War vet saw it and identified the people in whom he could see post-traumatic stress in their eyes in the first moments of seeing them. So, you know, he saw it in the midwife in the first shot of the film.
There are these interesting juxtapositions at various parts of the film. Sometimes you take us into a place like Foča, Bosnia, for example, and we stay there for a time. And then there are other times when we just sort of jump into different places for a few moments. And there are a few of these times where we see these various images sort of moving backward and forward. There's a lot of movement going on. Would you talk about that as a conceit for the film? I really liked that. I mean, where we have these one thing set against another. Like, for example, we see a mosque in, I think it's in Afghanistan, put right up against these girls in Colorado Springs dancing around a cross in a Christian church.
Yes, yes. Well, that's a particularly autobiographical moment in the film, but perhaps less clear to all. But I'm really interested in how religion impacts individuals' lives and societies, and I'm always sort of searching for the connections between things. And I was raised Seventh-day Adventist in Seattle, Washington, and really believed as a child. So I had this very strong, clear worldview that has since shifted enormously. And yet, whenever I go to a Muslim country, I feel this sort of intense time. It's like time travel into my childhood, where the call to prayer in Muslim countries, because it's a sound, it's a ubiquitous sound thing, yeah. You know, sort of it's everywhere in the air. It suddenly feels like I used to feel when I was a child. And I had this very particular Bible verse that I was obsessed with, which said that God knew your thoughts before you thought them. And I believed it, but that was really a conundrum for me. And I'm always reminded of it when I hear the call to prayer in Muslim countries.
We see a shot of a, I can't tell if it's a letter you wrote to God or a poem you wrote to God. This was from September, yes. September 16th, 1971. Saying you are
really
a great
nice
God.
Cursive handwriting at that time.
So, what was home life like for you in that sense? You had a kind of relationship with God, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, I was talking to Jesus in particular in my childhood. But one of the things that's just been a fascinating part of making Camera Person is to search back and try to find evidence of who I was, and realizing there was evidence in the footage that I didn't have to describe or explain things, that there was enough evidence for anyone who didn't know me to discover who I am without words describing it. So that little note to God is one of the few times that there are explicit words in the film. But there's no voiceover narration, and like you say, you sort of drop into these moments where I am searching, and then you as the audience are there with me, and we are searching together.
I can't believe you saved all this footage.
I didn't save all this footage. No, I didn't save all this footage. It was, I went back to all the directors that I worked with and asked if I could look at things again. And so, you know, that was incredibly gratifying, because people said yes, that they would let me look at the footage again, because in most cases it belonged to the directors, or in some cases to the studios or production companies that had made the films. And it was a real process of exploration, sort of getting an idea about a moment that I remembered, asking a director if I could see it, searching for where those tapes were. I mean, in most cases, they were tapes. I have the misfortune of having filmed through one of the most, you know, standard def integrated lens, not that great cameras on not that stable digital tape material I began working just when 16 millimeter ended, and this film sort of goes right up to high definition and stops just short of it all. But so we had to go search in people's closets and to find tapes.
Did you know right off, right at, as you began this project, that you were going to use the kind of breaking down the fourth wall stuff, where you're setting up shots, where you're kind of talking to yourself or talking to a producer?
No, not at all.
Really?
No. No. You know, because, you know, I think I really want to be clear about this. I did not have the idea to make this film. This film was a need in me. I really needed to look back at some footage, because the circumstances that I described in Afghanistan of sort of being blindsided by, here I am working with great joy and a lot of back and forth with this young woman who I really believe is fine and comfortable being in a film, and then to have her say, no, I'm not, that just really kicked me back on my heels and sort of said, what are my blind spots? Why did I not see this coming? And it just made me think about, what else didn't I understand? And the first thought was, maybe I could find some evidence of it in the footage. It was not necessarily that it could all come together in a film, but maybe I could understand more about what I was trying to do once this Afghanistan film fell apart.
It raised questions about the relationship you have with the people you're filming. There's one moment where you say off camera to someone, and I'm not sure who it is. It doesn't really matter. But you say you like having some kind of relationship with the people you're shooting. Because the question I think that this person was asking you is, do we need to get, you know, releases for all this, or is it okay?
Right,
and
right.
You're explaining that, and you say, well, I try to set up this relationship, kind of looking at them as if to say, look, you see me shooting, right? I mean, so how do you describe the relationship, if that's the way you describe it with the people you're shooting?
Yeah, well, I actually think an image is a relationship. Images can't exist without, they are relationships. And, you know, it's like this moment with you and me. We don't know each other. We aren't seeing each other. Mm-hmm. I'm in a studio in New York, and there's a microphone here. Yeah. So, you know, we're having a different kind of conversation than we would if we were just talking on the phone. Because the microphone is here, I'm speaking differently, and I'm trying to say things that sound good. Yeah. I'm trying to use this time well. And that often happens when people film, is this sort of acknowledgement of this technology in between us that represents the future. This radio show will exist sometime in the future, and maybe indefinitely into the future. So that changes the sort of freight of this conversation.
I want to ask you about, there's a moment we see the philosopher Jacques Derrida.
Saved my life.
Yeah, he saved your life. You almost got hit.
Yeah.
And, but it's such an interesting moment, I have to say. So you're walking across the street in Manhattan. It's busy. And he mentions...
And I'm walking backwards.
And you're walking backwards. And that's the thing. Like he says, typical as of a philosopher, he says... As a filmmaker or as a camera person, you're not looking where you're going. You see everything, but on the other hand, you're not really looking where you're going. And I'm wondering if you saw a metaphor in that.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, pretty much everything Jacques Derrida said was probably six metaphors. He was one of the first people that I ever filmed, and the rigor of his mind was so stimulating to be around that it really... opened up all kinds of questions for me that I have carried with me throughout my filming life, honestly. And, you know, you were saying earlier sort of what are the things that got me into making this film? And there's no question. I have been obsessed with the questions of ethics, the questions of what are the relationships I have with the people I film, questions of representation, my entire career. But this was really interesting to be able to go back into my own source material and question myself with the material I had shot.
I was surprised at how intense the film was.
Weren't we all?
Really? I mean, let's ask. I want to ask you about the scenes that we see in Nigeria in this maternity ward. Which, I'll be honest with you, at moments seemed almost unbearable, not because of the things that we were seeing, and I'm not sure how much you want to say about what we're seeing, but the uncertainty, the intensity, the sense of tension, which is such an interesting contrast to this woman who seemed so calm and so with it, yet the drama of the moment, your role in that, would you just say something about those moments?
Oh, absolutely. And I want to just speak to the construction of the film a little bit, too. You know, I worked with an incredible editor on the Afghanistan film, Amanda Laws, and then I worked with Nels Bangerter on this cut of Camera Person. And we really thought very specifically about how do we have this intensity creep up on the viewer in the same way that it crept up on me as a person. You know, I've traveled all around the world. I've been to, I think, 86 or 87 countries at this point. And for a long time, I was just like so thrilled and taking it in and wide-eyed. And I want to go there next. And oh my goodness, I can't believe someone's inviting me to go to India.
Right.
And then at a certain point, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. Wow, I've been to, you know, five post-genocidal regions. You know, that kind of thing. You don't see it coming, which is sort of what we wanted to have happen to you as a viewer in the film. You don't see everything coming, and you don't see what's going to hit you emotionally. And that's so true of life, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Nigeria ward, it's really interesting. Some people close their eyes when it's on the screen. And I recently had a fascinating argument with a Syrian filmmaker who was basically saying you must take that film, that scene out of the film.
Yeah. Is this the one that he appears in the film himself?
No, okay. No. The man who appears in the film is Sharif Kiwan, who is part of this collective who are really have a strong position around not showing bodies of dead Syrians.
Yeah.
And I think it's really I'm friends with quite a few Syrian filmmakers. There's a really active documentary community in Damascus, an incredible film festival called Doc's Box that ended when the war began. And many of those filmmakers are in exile, and some of them are still in Syria. And I'm just really fascinated. They're all in this great big dialogue about, do you show bodies? Do you show bodies in distress? How do you represent the humanity of people when a relentless war is going on? And so they all have really strong opinions and are in a lot of fights with each other. And I'm following that all very closely because I think anyone who is so intimately concerned with, you know, how is your family being represented? How is your country being represented in the middle of the war? And you have the capacities. You are a talented filmmaker. Mm. What kind of choices do you make about what you show or don't show? So I can tell you, we struggled to the very end. And I mean, we struggled into the sound mix with what we kept in and what we kept out of the Nigeria scene. Which many people cite as the heart of the film.
Yeah.
I would argue there are many hearts in the film.
Yeah, I think
but,
so, too.
but I don't absolutely.
I don't think that's a bad... I think that you're raising these questions in the film. Like, should we be seeing this? Do I want to see this? I mean, it's a theme in the film, it seems. Let me play that
absolutely.
Moment, actually, from Sharif Kiwan. Because I think this is... he's asked this question... by a student. He's talking to this group
yes.
of people. And the person is saying, look, I get how you don't want to show, you know, dead Syrians in the street, but doesn't, the student is saying, isn't it that you can take these images and make good things out of them? That little refugee boy whose body washes up in Turkey inspired a lot of compassion and empathy and movement for all of this. And that's the question that the student asks to Sharif Kiwan. Here's his response from the film.
When you focus on death, you say, it's done, it's finished. No, there is nothing to do except voyeurism, except watch and... So here is the main problem for us. We have to find a way to represent horror, to represent the death, respecting the golden rule, dignity.
Is that something you are working out as a photographer and a director all the time, especially in some of the places where you've been shooting? How you're going to convey horror and yet maintain dignity?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things that I balk really strongly at is when we only show people as victims or we only show people suffering violence. And it's a real conundrum. You know, I mean, I think this moment in American history where we're all very tuned into the possibilities of police abuse and who is the potential target of police abuse, you know, sort of young men of color. We want to see those images, and yet the repetition of seeing young black men being hurt is as pernicious in some ways as portraying young black men as criminals. And, you know, we all know a lot of teenage boys who we know those images hurt them personally. And so as we try to educate and you know, shift the world into a place where racism is less vicious and less systematic, what does that do to us as individuals who are taking in these really strong images? That a lot of times you open your computer and you just, you know, you're just trying to read the news and boom, you're seeing something that's devastating.
Yeah. There's a... we see footage in your film from a documentary made in 2002, Two Towns of Jasper. This is from Jasper County, Texas. It's, of course, the trial of James Byrd, who was dragged to death. I'm sure people know of that horrible story. And in this, there's a moment I want to play from it. This was another moment that was hard to, like, see or even hear.
Listen to.
Even
described.
Worse.
It's
described. I'm only going to play a bit of that.
Okay.
But this is Jasper County District Attorney Guy James Gray, who is talking about, he has in his hands this book of photographs that they gave to the jurors. So they didn't have to show them up on the on a screen. And there are, of course, the horrible images of James Byrd's mutilated body after having been dragged to death. And I want to play this moment because this idea of what to see and what not to see, and we're anyway, let me play this moment because I want to. Yeah. So here's again, Guy James Gray.
And you see the degree of flesh that's torn away during that process, you begin to get mad. Hearing somebody talk about it and actually looking at it is different. We gave each juror a copy of this booklet, and that eliminated the need of showing the pictures on a screen or showing them in a courtroom. That creates a lot of extra emotion. We had all the emotion we needed in this case without adding to it.
Okay, so now later in the film, we come back to this this footage. And so I'm guessing it's the director. I'm not sure. It wasn't you. Somebody asks.
Yeah, it was Whitney Dow, the director. Yeah.
Can we see some of the photos? And he says, well, I'd have to sort of see what we could show. But it just seemed like, really, you want to see the photos? Why are you asking
I was conflicted by that. Yeah, well, I think to be fair to Whitney and to Marco Williams, who did incredible work on The Two Towns of Jasper, this is the challenge of doing a film about subject matter like that.
Yeah.
You have to discover and explore what it is before you decide what you're going to put into the film.
Right.
And you have to be sort of terribly unafraid and walk very gingerly. I know that... they spent an incredible amount of time with various members of the Byrd family, as well as many people in the town and the brother of one of the accused killers. You know, this is what documentarians do. They go into incredibly charged situations and they find the people who are living through them. And then together, and this is where we call images relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Together, people decide, what do they want to say? What do they want to let be filmed? Do they want to stop the filming in the moment that it's happening? Mm-hmm. And what I found so incredible about that Guy James Gray footage is that he really articulates one of the central dilemmas of the life of a documentarian. He alludes to permission. We need permission from the family to look at it. Why would we look at it? What good does it do to look at it? And yet he knows the power of the images, and you can see it from the look in his eyes that he knows the power of the images and is haunted by them.
That's Kirsten Johnson. Next Wednesday night, that's March 8th, we're going to be screening her film Camera Person at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Kirsten will be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the documentary cinematographer Kirsten Johnson about the film that she's made using footage from some of the many places she's been. It's a memoir of her life's work, a collage assembled from the footage of some 24 films. It's an examination of the dilemmas and blind spots that come with constructing a story. It's called Camera Person. that premiered at the 2016 Sundance Film Festival. We're going to be showing it next week. Kirsten will be joining us then. We'll give you more of those details a little bit later on the program. She's joining us today from a studio in New York City. Let's talk about Foča, Bosnia.
Sure.
Seems like you have a soft spot in your heart for this family. And this place.
No question.
Yeah, of course.
No question. I mean, I don't know if you can tell, but I got a lot of soft spots.
That's true.
You know, I mean, I fall in love with people when I film them. And I do think that, you know, it's not an uncommon thing for a photographer or a camera person. I think the lens, especially a long lens, gives you this capacity to look really deep into people's eyes. And it gives you this permission and this reason to get really physically close to people, especially if you like to shoot with a wide lens. So a lot of times you're literally touching the person that you're filming. And that's a big deal. The difference between looking at someone and actually talking with them, laughing with them, literally touching them, those kind of things go deep into you. And it happened to me in Foča. And I had the lucky chance to be able to go back there.
Yeah.
I think I could have made the scene of my return to many places I have filmed because I have a soft spot for just about everywhere I've been.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of moments in this section in Foča. One moment that I loved was this older woman, very stylishly dressed,
mm-hmm.
Rolls her own cigarettes.
You should see what I'm wearing. I'm here in gold pants and gold shoes. Yes,
really?
I am.
Good. Okay. That's good enough. But it's
inspired
so
inspired by her.
So she, you're talking to her, trying to get her to explain what they may have been through, what kind of violence they may have been exposed to. And it seems like she doesn't really want to talk about it or isn't, you know, she really deflects a bit.
Absolutely.
And then is it you that asks her about her style? That's you.
Me.
So you said, okay. So you say, I want to change the subject. Have you always been this stylish? And she really brightens up talking about her sense of style. I found that so surprising. Would you talk about that?
And so, you know, that's the thing. That's the thing. I think that a lot of times when you're filming, you get access to someone's sense of humor, or you can tell what's really distinct about them. And then suddenly you sit down for an interview or you film a scene and you realize that what's being captured is a one-dimensional portrait of someone, and often one that adheres to, you know, what we think we already know about a place. So I often have this very odd sensation of loss as I am filming, that I am doing wrong by the person because their complexity, there's no space for their complexity in the film that we're making. And that was really a little bit of a mutiny, me sort of interjecting in that moment. Because, you know, I think, especially when people are talking about traumatic, violent experiences that they've lived through, you know, it's one thing to agree to be filmed and to agree to revisit those memories. But when you actually do it, all kinds of things happen to you, on the inside and emotionally that you don't expect. And so, you know, in most of the cases when we're filming, I really work with directors who have great empathy and who are, you know, very much connected to listening to the people that they're interviewing. And often we're working with translators, as we were in this particular case. And it was just me and the translator. The director was doing some other work at that moment. And so I did feel like I could interject in that moment because it was just so clear that she did not want to talk about it, and she did not feel the capacity to say, no, I can't talk about this. So sometimes I feel like I'm an advocate for the person that I'm filming because people don't always understand that they have the power to change their minds about being filmed or to say, please stop, please don't film this, or I can't do this. And I think of myself, you know, the camera has power, and I'm the one wielding that power, and I feel like sometimes I have to reach across the aisle and say to the person being filmed, it's okay, we can stop, we can take a break, you don't have to go there. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes that's in the service of the film, right? It's in the service of gaining even more trust so that they open up more. So it's not that I'm just this incredibly altruistic, empathetic person. It's that I'm, you know, I'm a really thinking filmmaker, and I'm trying to gauge, do we press now, do we not press now?
There are two times, at least two times anyway, in the film where people are going to wonder if, Kristen, you should intervene here. This might not go well. There are these two kids playing with a hatchet. This is in Focha. Also, there's the maternity ward stuff that I wondered. Mm-hmm. I'm like, dude,
absolutely,
you need to get her. Or so. Would you talk about that? Because that is such a great illustration of when you step in and when you don't.
Yeah. Well, I honestly, the sort of thing I say back often when we talk about this idea of intervention, being there with a camera is an intervention.
Right.
That is already an intervention. What the outcome of that intervention will be and or how many outcomes it may have is sort of wildly unpredictable. But I love the scene with the kids chopping with the axe because of the many scenes that I could have chosen that show the ethical dilemmas of do you put down the camera and pull someone out of the water? Do you, you know, sort of all these questions that we have. That one shows that it is a second by second negotiation. Right. It's literally like, no, that kid's fine. No, he's not fine. He's not fine. Oh, there he's fine. No, he's fine. Right. You know, and that's what it is. And, you know, I think really early on in my career, I thought, oh, I can just decide to be a decent person. I can be an ethical person. And it is a second by second negotiation.
I want to ask you about Velma Saric. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, well done. Nicely done.
Good. she's a translator and a field producer in Sarajevo. And she's great because she's speaking with a war crimes investigator. I'm going to blow his name. Is it Sajid Koso?
It's Seo.
Seo.
Okay. Yeah.
Knew I wouldn't get that right. No, I wouldn't get them both. And they're talking about the impact, about how Seos talks about what it takes out of you when someone shows you, for example, the place where they had been raped. And Velma says, you know, we really have to process these stories and put them, as she says, inside ourselves. And then she raises this question of how we free ourselves from that. And it seems like one of the questions you must be asking yourself. But I want to play this moment with Velma talking about, because she says how she has these nightmares of these women, these dreams that come to her. Let me play this moment and we can talk about it.
Okay.
I woke up sometimes and I'm hearing voice saying, like, you need to do something for women who have been raped. And I'm saying, like, yes, I will. It's just we basically talk about the fact that actually nobody... We never go to our own trauma. We are just putting things inside of ourselves by thinking this is something what we need to do and it's a work. But it's really heavy work because after you perceive thousands of stories and putting in yourself, what is your channel to let it go? So, yeah, it makes me a little bit angry, it does. But I mean, I couldn't choose where I will be born and what will happen. So,
this comes to you too, right? I'm not sure if you have nightmares or dreams, but that the idea of taking something that you see and putting it inside yourself and how you cope with that, you must think about that.
Oh, yeah. And, I think working on this project has made me think about how many people there are in the world like that who take in other people's stories at scale. So, you know, teachers, policemen, police people. I'm calling everything people these days.
Yeah.
I've got my 5-year-olds calling, you know, fire people and police people,
right,
and camera people. But there are a lot of us in the world who it is our job to listen and encounter many people's stories. You are in the team with me, right? You've heard a lot. You've talked to a lot of people, and your job is to just plunge right in and go for the deepest, most connected conversation you can. And that's why you're great at your job, right? And what happened to me in Bosnia was I got asked to go and do a master class there at the Sarajevo Film Festival. And I suddenly thought, wow, I'd love to go back and visit the family in Foča. And so I reached out to Velma, who'd been just fabulous on the first shoot. And she said, oh, yeah, Sayo will drive us. And so we did this great drive to Foča, which is, you know, Sayo and Velma are Bosnian, and they are going into this Serb-controlled territory where they literally don't want to stop at a cafe and go to the bathroom. It's so hostile, even though there is, you know, ostensibly no war going on. But it's gorgeous countryside. And so we had this incredible talk on the way up, and I realized, oh, my goodness, they have been obsessing about this film that we shot 5 years ago and all the things we went through, just like I have. And at the end of the drive, I was like, you guys, can I film you tomorrow?
Right.
And they were like, and they both said, oh, we don't have that much to say. And I think they spoke for 3 hours in that cafe nonstop in Bosnian, and then finally translated a little bit of it to me.
That's the director, Kirsten Johnson. Next Wednesday night, that's March 8th, we're going to be screening her film Camera Person at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Kirsten will be there for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Kirsten Johnson. We're talking about her documentary film, Camera Person, which we're going to be screening next week. It's part of our documentary film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Kirsten will be joining us. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. She's joining us today from a studio in New York City. Can we talk about your mom?
Sure.
Where did you figure she fit in to the other images, the other places?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that all of us understand certain things intellectually, right? We sort of can think about problems in the world. But then there are some things that are really ours, that we own completely. And I think we can all relate to this. And I think most of us own our relationship to our mother. And my mother was just this fabulous person with a real visual sense and a real sense of herself in the world, and she would have hated to be filmed with Alzheimer's, hated to be seen in that image. And I do think this is it's a historical difference. I think now, because of the ubiquity of cameras, because of all of our smartphones and Facebook feeds, people are more used to and comfortable with being filmed and can imagine there will be multiple versions or multiple moments of themselves recorded for forever. Mm. But in my mother's generation, you know, to be filmed was a very rare thing.
Yeah.
And so a rare and loaded thing. And so, you know, I know very clearly that she, part of her would have been completely despondent at the idea that this is the image of her that will last. And yet, it is also they are the only images, filmed images I have of her. And they are the images that express, you know, the great tenderness and loss and, you know, just incredible complexity that is Alzheimer's and that it creates in relationships. All of that is in those images. So I really wanted to use them for my purposes. And that's what storytelling is, using other people's life experiences for your storytelling purposes. And that's a pretty complicated thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And I felt like using the material of my mother implicitly addresses that.
You don't have any regrets about that, do you?
You know, I only have regrets that my mother's not still alive to be upset with me and talk to me about it.
Right.
But I screened it in Seattle to a large group of people who were people that she had gone to church with for over 50 years. And the array of responses was incredible. But one of my favorites was someone who came up and said, "That was not Katie Jo. That image was not Katie Jo." And it was literally like she was expressing the sort of curt anger that my mother would have had.
Yeah.
And it just, it felt so good because this person actually knew my mother. And that was the response that I believed my mother would have. So that was something that for me, it was just one more connection. You know, as people we love, when they die, there are fewer and fewer people who knew them. And so you have these great bonds with the people who knew them and knew who they really were. Mm. But what I love about Camera Person, it's creating all these bonds into the future. So many people feel connected to Katie Jo who never met her. And I do think that's the magic of cinema.
There is this really powerful montage. I'm not sure that's the right word, but a collection of images.
You can use it.
Is that all right? I know. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Anyway, a collection of images of these places that where this violence or these terrible things took place. Like one after the other, this sports hall where these rapes took place and this house where these women were enslaved and raped and this motel.
You're really making people want to see this movie.
No, I mean, look, it's really, really powerful to see those images. What I think is, like, it's not a downer. I guess in some ways you can say it is, but we're seeing, like, flowers bloom. Like, it's a weird contrast. Mm. And I think it's really interesting. It seems kind of hopeful.
Well, I'm often faced with this very odd and peculiar challenge when I work of trying to film something that happened in a place. Not something that's happening, but something that happened. So I'm often faced with having to film absence or invisibility. I went to Guantanamo to film for The Oath and wasn't really allowed to film anything. Mm-hmm. So then what could I film? And so that quest to find the absences and to understand what can be conveyed by by an aesthetic choice, by a composition or a moment in which you film or a duration with which you film? How can you translate what was there, what happened there? That montage in the film, in some ways, just sort of an endless, it just could go on and on. For us, for Nels Bengerder and I, it was just such a interesting experience trying to find how to calibrate it, what to choose, what to put next to what. And there was a woman at a Q&A I did who was just outraged that I had put two images next to each other. And she sort of said, "How dare you put that image next to that image?"
Wow.
And I just thought that was so fascinating because it is true. A film must own its structure. In its structure and in its construction of images, it is saying something. And those juxtapositions do say things. And yet, all that I am saying in that, in Camera Person in certain ways, I was there. This is how I framed this place where these many people were killed.
Mm.
And I have done that in many places around the world, and I am showing you all of those places where that is true.
I want to ask you finally about Najibullah Afghan. I really loved this kid and don't know anything about him. I'm not sure I'd seen the film where you shot originally, but I don't want to play this moment, but I want to talk about it because I don't want to give too much away, but it's a really powerful moment toward the end of the film where he's talking about his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awful what happens. And clearly you are affected by the story. And you say it's hurting. You're explaining to him because you're reacting to this story.
Mm.
and you didn't even understand the language, but you had a sense of how awful it might have been. Can you talk about that moment?
Yeah, well, Najib can speak English and Dari, but I had asked him to speak in Dari because I knew he would be more comfortable, and I didn't have a translator with me. But I, you know, would ask him a question and then listen, which is often what I'm doing. I have to listen to languages that I don't understand. So I'm really sort of cued into anything else as emotional information I can get from the person as they're speaking, and certainly looking intently into their eyes. And with Najib, I mean, the description of what happened to him and his brother in a language I did not understand was devastating. I mean, I was literally sort of sobbing and trying to keep quiet behind the camera and trying to, you know, these are the kind of questions that you ask yourself as a camera person. Do I show the person I'm listening to how much they're making me cry, or do I hide behind the camera? Those are questions we ask ourselves as camera people. You know, it's interesting. I spoke again with Najib fairly recently, and he said, "Oh, you know, that way I told you, it's still so thin. It's not the way I would tell my mother the story."
Kirsten Johnson, next Wednesday night, that's March 8th, we're going to be screening her film. It's called Camera Person, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Kirsten will be there for a Q&A after the film. As I said before, we have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Kirsten Johnson joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.